The golden dust filled the air in the arena at the Salinas Rodeo. The announcer called the roping contests. When Jody rode the black horse to the starting chute, the other contestants shrugged and gave up first place, for it was well known that Jody and Demon could rope and throw and tie a steer a great deal quicker than any roping team of two men could. Jody was not a boy anymore, and Demon was not a horse. The two together were one glorious individual. And then the president wrote a letter and asked them to help catch a bandit in Washington. Jody settled himself comfortably in the grass. The little stream of water whined into the mossy tub. The year passed slowly on. Time after time, Jody gave up his colt for lost. No change had taken place in Nellie. Carl Tiflin still drove her to a light cart, and she pulled on a hay rake and worked the Jackson Fork tackle when the hay was being put into the barn. The summer passed, and the warm, bright autumn. And then the frantic morning winds began to twist along the ground, and a chill came into the air, and the poison oak turned red. One morning in September, when he had finished his breakfast, Jody's mother called him into the kitchen. She was pouring boiling water into a bucket full of dry middlings and stirring the materials to a steaming paste. "Yes, ma'am?" Jody asked. "Watch how I do it. You'll have to do it after this every other morning." "Well, what is it?" "Why, it's warm mash for Nellie. It'll keep her in good shape." Jody rubbed his forehead with a knuckle. "Is she all right?" he asked timidly. Mrs. Tiflin put down the kettle and stirred the mash with a wooden paddle. "Of course she's all right, only you've got to take better care of her from now on. Here, take this breakfast out to her." Jody seized the bucket and ran down past the bunkhouse, past the barn, with the heavy bucket banging against his knees. He found Nellie playing with the water in the trough, pushing waves and tossing her head so that the water slopped out on the ground. Jody climbed the fence and set the bucket of steaming mash beside her. Then he stepped back to look at her. And she was changed. Her stomach was swollen. When she moved, her feet touched the ground gently. She buried her nose in the bucket and gobbled the hot breakfast. And when she had finished and had pushed the bucket around the ground with her nose a little, she stepped quietly over to Jody and rubbed her cheek against him. Billy Buck came out of his saddle room and walked over. "Starts fast when it starts, doesn't it?"
"Did it come all at once?"
"Oh, no. You just stopped looking for a while." He pulled her head around toward Jody. "She's going to be nice, too. See how nice her eyes are? Some mares get mean, but when they turn nice, they just love everything." Nellie slipped her head under Billy's arm and rubbed her neck up and down between his arm and his side. "You better treat her awful nice now," Billy said.
"How long will it be?" Jody demanded breathlessly.
The man counted in whispers on his fingers. "About 3 months," he said aloud. "You can't tell exactly. Sometimes it's 11 months to the day, but it might be 2 weeks early or a month late without hurting anything." Jody looked hard at the ground.
"Billy," he began nervously, "Billy, you'll call me when it's getting born, won't you? You'll let me be there, won't you?"
Billy bit the tip of Nellie's ear with his front teeth. "Carl says he wants you to start right at the start. That's the only way to learn. Nobody can tell you anything. Like my old man did with me about the saddle blanket. He was a government packer when I was your size, and I helped him some. One day I left a wrinkle in my saddle blanket and made a saddle sore. My old man didn't give me hell at all, but the next morning he saddled me up with a 40-pound stock saddle. I had to lead my horse and carry that saddle over a whole damn mountain in the sun. It darn near killed me, but I never left no wrinkles in a blanket again. I couldn't. I never in my life since then put on a blanket, but I felt that saddle on my back." Jody reached up a hand and took hold of Nellie's mane.
"You'll tell me what to do about everything, won't you? I guess you know everything about horses, don't you?"
Billy laughed. "Why, I'm half horse myself, you see," he said. "My ma died when I was born, and being my old man was a government packer in the mountains and no cows around most of the time, why, he just gave me mostly mare's milk.
he continued seriously. "And horses know that. Don't you know it, Nellie?"
The mare turned her head and looked full into his eyes for a moment, and this is a thing horses practically never do. Billy was proud and sure of himself now. He boasted a little.
"I'll see you get a good colt. I'll start you right. And if you do like I say, you'll have the best horse in the county."
That made Jody feel warm and proud, too. So proud that when he went back to the house, he bowed his legs and swayed his shoulders as horsemen do. And he whispered,
"Whoa, you black demon, you! Steady down there and keep your feet on the ground."
The winter fell sharply. A few preliminary gusty showers and then a strong, steady rain. The hills lost their straw color and blackened under the water, and the winter streams scrambled noisily down the canyons. The mushrooms and puffballs popped up, and the new grass started before Christmas. But this year Christmas was not the central day to Jody. Some undetermined time in January had become the axis day around which the month swung. When the rains fell, he put Nellie in a box stall and fed her warm food every morning and curried her and brushed her. The mare was swelling so greatly that Jody became alarmed.
"She'll pop wide open," he said to Billy.
Billy laid his strong, square hand against Nellie's swollen abdomen.
"Feel here," he said quietly. "You can feel it move. I guess it would surprise you if there were twin colts."
"You don't think so?" Jody cried. "You don't think it'll be twins, do you, Billy?"
"No, I don't. But it does happen sometimes."
During the first 2 weeks of January, it rained steadily. Jody spent most of his time when he wasn't in school in the box stall with Nellie. 20 times a day, he put his hand on her stomach to feel the colt move. Nellie became more and more gentle and friendly to him. She rubbed her nose on him. She whinnied softly when he walked into the barn. Carl Tiflin came to the barn with Jody one day. He looked admiringly at the groomed bay coat, and he felt the firm flesh over ribs and shoulders.
"You've done a good job," he said to Jody.
And this was the greatest praise he knew how to give. Jody was tight with pride for hours afterward. The 15th of January came, and the colt was not born. And the 20th came. A lump of fear began to form in Jody's stomach.
"Is it all right?" he demanded of Billy.
"Oh, sure."
And again,
"Are you sure it's going to be all right?"
Billy stroked the mare's neck. She swayed her head uneasily.
"I told you it wasn't always the same time, Jody. You just have to wait."
When the end of the month arrived with no birth, Jody grew frantic. Nellie was so big that her breath came heavily and her ears were close together and straight up as though her head ached. Jody's sleep grew restless and his dreams confused. On the night of the 2nd of February, he awakened crying. His mother called to him, "Jody, you're dreaming. Wake up and start over again." But Jody was filled with terror and desolation. He lay quietly a few moments, waiting for his mother to go back to sleep, and then he slipped his clothes on and crept out in his bare feet. The night was black and thick. A little misting rain fell. The cypress tree in the bunkhouse loomed and then dropped back into the mist. The barn door screeched as he opened it, a thing it never did in the daytime. Jody went to the rack and found a lantern and a tin box of matches. He lighted the wick and walked down the long, straw-covered aisle to Nellie's stall. She was standing up. Her whole body weaved from side to side. Jody called to her,
"So, Nellie, so, Nellie,"
but she did not stop her swaying nor look around. When he stepped into the stall and touched her on the shoulder, she shivered under his hand. Then Billy Buck's voice came from the hayloft right above the stall.
"Jody, what are you doing?"
Jody started back and turned miserable eyes up toward the nest where Billy was lying in the hay.
"Is she all right, do you think?"
"Why, sure, I think so."
"You won't let anything happen, Billy? You're sure you won't?"
Billy growled down at him. "I told you I'd call you, and I will. Now you get back to bed and stop worrying that mare. She's got enough to do without you worrying her." Jody cringed, for he had never heard Billy speak in such a tone.
"I only thought I'd come and see," he said. "I woke up."
Billy softened a little then. "Well, you get to bed. I don't want you bothering her. I told you I'd get you a good colt. Get along now."
Jody walked slowly out of the barn. He blew out the lantern and set it in the rack. The blackness of the night and the chilled mist struck him and enfolded him. He wished he believed everything Billy said, as he had before the pony died. It was a moment before his eyes, blinded by the feeble lantern flame, could make any form of the darkness. The damp ground chilled his bare feet. At the cypress tree, the roosting turkeys chattered a little in alarm, and the two good dogs responded to their duty and came charging out, barking to frighten away the coyotes they thought were prowling under the tree. As he crept through the kitchen, Jody stumbled over a chair. Carl called from his bedroom, "Who's there? What's the matter there?" And Mrs. Tiflin said sleepily, "What's the matter, Carl?" The next second, Carl came out of the bedroom carrying a candle and found Jody before he could get into bed.
"What are you doing out?"
Jody turned shyly away.
"I was down to see the mayor."
For a moment, anger at being awakened fought with approval in Jody's father. "Listen," he said finally, "there's not a man in this country that knows more about colts than Billy. You leave it to him." Words burst out of Jody's mouth.
"But the pony died."
"Don't you go blaming that on him," Carl said sternly. "If Billy can't save a horse, it can't be saved."
Mrs. Tiflin called, "Make him clean his feet and go to bed, Carl. He'll be sleepy all day tomorrow." It seemed to Jody that he had just closed his eyes to try to go to sleep when he was shaken violently by the shoulder. Billy Buck stood beside him, holding a lantern in his hand.
"Get up," he said. "Hurry up."
He turned and walked quickly out of the room. Mrs. Tiflin called, "What's the matter? Is that you, Billy?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"Is Nellie ready?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"All right, I'll get up and heat some water in case you need it."
Jody jumped into his clothes so quickly that he was out the back door before Billy's swinging lantern was halfway to the barn. There was a rim of dawn on the mountaintops, but no light had penetrated into the cup of the ranch yet. Jody ran frantically after the lantern and caught up to Billy just as he reached the barn. Billy hung the lantern to a nail on the stall side and took off his blue denim coat. Jody saw that he wore only a sleeveless shirt under it. Nellie was standing rigid and stiff. While they watched, she crouched. Her whole body was wrung with a spasm. The spasm passed, but in a few moments it started over again and passed. Billy muttered nervously, "There's something wrong." His bare hand disappeared.
"Oh, Jesus," he said, "it's wrong."
The spasm came again, and this time Billy strained and the muscles stood out on his arm and shoulder. He heaved strongly, his forehead beaded with perspiration. Nellie cried with pain. Billy was muttering,
"It's wrong. I can't turn it. It's way wrong. It's turned all around wrong."
He glared wildly toward Jody, and then his fingers made a careful, careful diagnosis. His cheeks were growing tight and gray. He looked for a long, questioning minute at Jody standing back of the stall. Then Billy stepped to the rack under the manure window and picked up a horseshoe hammer with his wet right hand.
"Go outside, Jody," he said.
The boy stood still and stared dully at him.
"Go outside, I tell you, it'll be too late."
Jody didn't move. Then Billy walked quickly to Nellie's head. He cried,
"Turn your face away, damn you, turn your face!"
This time Jody obeyed. His head turned sideways. He heard Billy whispering hoarsely in the stall. And then he heard a hollow crunch of bone. Nellie chuckled shrilly. Jody looked back in time to see the hammer rise and fall again on the flat forehead. Then Nellie fell heavily to her side and quivered for a moment. Billy jumped to the swollen stomach. His big pocket knife was in his hand. He lifted the skin and drove the knife in. He sawed and ripped at the tough belly. The air filled with the sick odor of warm, living entrails.
The other horses reared back against their halter chains and squealed and kicked. Billy dropped the knife. Both of his arms plunged into the terrible, ragged hole and dragged out a big, white, dripping bundle. His teeth tore a hole in the covering. A little black head appeared through the tear and little slick, wet ears. A gurgling breath was drawn, and then another. Billy shucked off the sack and found his knife and cut the string. For a moment he held the little black colt in his arms and looked at it. And then he walked slowly over and laid it in the straw at Jody's feet. Billy's face and arms and chest were dripping red. His body shivered and his teeth chattered. His voice was gone. He spoke in a throaty whisper.
"There's your colt. I promised. And there it is. I had to do it. Had to."
He stopped and looked over his shoulder into the box stall.
"Go get hot water and a sponge," he whispered. "Wash him and dry him the way his mother would. You'll have to feed him by hand. But there's your colt, the way I promised."
Jody stared stupidly at the wet, panting foal. It stretched on its chin and tried to raise its head. Its blank eyes were navy blue.
"God damn you!" Billy shouted. "Will you go now for the water? Will you go?"
Then Jody turned and trotted out of the barn into the dawn. He ached from his throat to his stomach. His legs were stiff and heavy. He tried to be glad because of the colt, but the bloody face and the haunted, tired eyes of Billy Buck hung in the air ahead of him. The Leader of the People. On Saturday afternoon, Billy Buck, the ranch hand, raked together the last of the old year's haystack and pitched small forkfuls over the wire fence to a few mildly interested cattle. High in the air, small clouds, like puffs of cannon smoke, were driven eastward by the March wind. The wind could be heard wishing in the brush on the ridge crests, but no breath of it penetrated down into the ranch cup. The little boy, Jody, emerged from the house eating a thick piece of buttered bread. He saw Billy working on the last of the haystack. Jody tramped down, scuffing his shoes in a way he had been told was destructive to good shoe leather. A flock of white pigeons flew out of the black cypress tree as Jody passed, and circled the tree and landed again. A half-grown tortoiseshell cat leaped from the bunkhouse porch, galloped on stiff legs across the road, whirled, and galloped back again. Jody picked up a stone to help the game along, but he was too late, for the cat was under the porch before the stone could be discharged. He threw the stone into the cypress tree and started the white pigeons on another whirling flight. Arriving at the used-up haystack, the boy leaned against the barbed wire fence.
"Will that be all of it, do you think?" he asked.
The middle-aged ranch hand stopped his careful raking and stuck his fork into the ground. He took off his black hat and smoothed down his hair.
"Nothing left of it that isn't soggy from ground moisture," he said.
He replaced his hat and rubbed his dry, leathery hands together.
"Ought to be plenty mice," Jody suggested.
"Lousy with 'em," said Billy. "Just crawling with mice."
"Well, maybe when you get all through I could call the dogs and hunt the mice."
"Sure, I guess you could," said Billy Buck.
He lifted a forkful of the damp ground hay and threw it into the air. Instantly, three mice leaped out and burrowed frantically under the hay again. Jody sighed with satisfaction. Those plump, sleek, arrogant mice were doomed. For 8 months they had lived and multiplied in the haystack. They had been immune from cats, from traps, from poison, and from Jody. They had grown smug in their security, overbearing and fat. Now the time of disaster had come. They would not survive another day. Billy looked up at the top of the hills that surrounded the ranch.
"Maybe you better ask your father before you do it," he suggested.
"Well, where is he? I'll ask him now."
"He rode up to the Ridge Ranch after dinner. He'll be back pretty soon."
Jody slumped against the fence post.
"I don't think he'd care."
As Billy went back to his work, he said ominously, "You'd better ask him anyway. You know how he is."
Jody did know. His father, Carl Tiflin, insisted upon giving permission for anything that was done on the ranch, whether it was important or not. Jody sagged farther against the post until he was sitting on the ground. He looked up at the little puffs of wind-driven cloud.
"Is it like to rain, Billy?"
"It might. The wind's good for it, but not strong enough."
"Well, I hope it don't rain until after I kill those damn mice."
He looked over his shoulder to see whether Billy had noticed the mature profanity. Billy worked on without comment. Jody turned back and looked at the side hill where the road from the outside world came down. The hill was washed with lean March sunshine. Silver thistles, blue lupins, and a few poppies bloomed among the sage bushes. Halfway up the hill, Jody could see Doubletree Mutt, the black dog, digging in a squirrel hole. He paddled for a while and then paused to kick bursts of dirt out between his hind legs, and he dug with an earnestness which belied the knowledge he must have had that no dog had ever caught a squirrel by digging in a hole. Suddenly, while Jody watched, the black dog stiffened and backed out of the hole and looked up the hill toward the cleft in the ridge where the road came through. Jody looked up, too. For a moment Carl Tiflin, on horseback, stood out against the pale sky, and then he moved down the road toward the house. He carried something white in his hand. The boy started to his feet.
"He's got a letter!" Jody cried.
He trotted away toward the ranch house, for the letter would probably be read aloud, and he wanted to be there. He reached the house before his father did and ran in. He heard Carl dismount from his creaking saddle and slap the horse on the side to send it to the barn, where Billy would unsaddle it and turn it out. Jody ran into the kitchen.
"We got a letter," he cried.
His mother looked up from a pan of beans.
"Who has?"
"Father has. I saw it in his hand."
Carl strode into the kitchen then, and Jody's mother asked,
"Who's the letter from, Carl?"
He frowned quickly. "How did you know there was a letter?" She nodded her head in the boy's direction.
"Big Britches Jody told me."
Jody was embarrassed. His father looked down at him contemptuously.
"He is getting to be a Big Britches," Carl said. "He's minding everybody's business but his own. Got his big nose into everything."
Mrs. Tiflin relented a little.
"Well, he hasn't enough to keep him busy. Who's the letter from?"
Carl still frowned on Jody.
"I'll keep him busy if he isn't careful."
He held out a sealed letter.
"I guess it's from your father."
Mrs. Tiflin took a hairpin from her head and slid open the flap. Her lips pursed judiciously. Jody saw her eyes snap back and forth over the lines.
"He says," she translated, "he says he's going to drive out Saturday to stay for a little while." "Why, this is Saturday. The letter must have been delayed."
She looked at the postmark.
"This was mailed day before yesterday. It should have been here yesterday."
She looked up questioningly at her husband, and then her face darkened angrily.
"Now what have you got that look on you for? He doesn't come often."
Carl turned his eyes away from her anger. He could be stern with her most of the time, but when occasionally her temper arose, he could not combat it.
"What's the matter with you?" she demanded again.
In his explanation, there was a tone of apology Jody himself might have used.
"It's just that he talks," Carl said lamely. "Just talks."
"Well, what of it? You talk yourself."
"Sure I do, but your father only talks about one thing."
"Indians," Jody broke in excitedly. "Indians and crossing the plains."
Carl turned fiercely on him.
"You get out, Mr. Big Britches. Go on now, get out."
Jody went miserably out the back door and closed the screen with elaborate quietness. Under the kitchen window, his shamed, downcast eyes fell upon a curiously shaped stone, a stone of such fascination that he squatted down and picked it up and turned it over in his hands. The voices came clearly to him through the open kitchen window.
"Jody's damn well right," he heard his father say. "Just Indians and crossing the plains. I've heard that story about how the horses got driven off about 1,000 times. He just goes on, and he never changes a word in the things he tells."
When Mrs. Tiflin answered, her tone was so changed that Jody, outside the window, looked up from his study of the stone. Her voice had become soft and explanatory. Jody knew how her face would have changed to match the tone. She said quietly, "Look at it this way, Carl. That was the big thing in my father's life. He led a wagon train clear across the plains to the coast, and when it was finished, his life was done. It was a big thing to do, but it didn't last long enough. Look," she continued, "it's as though he was born to do that, and after he finished it, there wasn't anything more for him to do but think about it and talk about it. If there'd been any farther west to go, he'd have gone. He's told me so himself. But at last there was the ocean. He lives right by the ocean where he had to stop." She had caught Carl, caught him and entangled him in her soft tone. "I've seen him," he agreed quietly. "He goes down and stares off west over the ocean." His voice sharpened a little. "And then he goes up to the Horseshoe Club in Pacific Grove and he tells people how the Indians drove off the horses." She tried to catch him again. "Well, it's everything to him. You might be patient with him and pretend to listen." Carl turned impatiently away. "Well, if it gets too bad, I can always go down to the bunkhouse and sit with Billy," he said irritably. He walked through the house and slammed the front door after him. Jody ran to his chores. He dumped the grain to the chickens without chasing any of them. He gathered the eggs from the nests. He trotted into the house with the wood and interlaced it so carefully in the wood box that two armloads seemed to fill it to overflowing. His mother had finished the beans by now. She stirred up the fire and brushed off the stovetop with turkey wing. Jody peered cautiously at her to see whether any rancor toward him remained. "Is he coming today?" Jody asked. "That's what his letter said. Maybe I better walk up the road to meet him." Mrs. Tiflin clanged the stove lid shut. "That would be nice," she said. "He'd probably like to be met."
"I guess I'll just do it then."
Outside, Jody whistled shrilly to the dogs. "Come on up the hill," he commanded. The two dogs waved their tails and ran ahead. Along the roadside, the sage had tender new tips. Jody tore off some pieces and rubbed them on his hands until the air was filled with the sharp, wild smell. With a rush, the dogs leaped from the road and yapped into the brush after a rabbit. That was the last Jody saw of them, for when they failed to catch the rabbit, they went back home. Jody plodded on up the hill toward the ridgetop. When he reached the little cleft where the road came through, the afternoon wind struck him and blew up his hair and ruffled his shirt. He looked down on the little hills and ridges below and then out at the huge green Salinas Valley. He could see the white town of Salinas far out in the flat and the flash of its windows under the waning sun. Directly below him in an oak tree, a crow congress had convened. The tree was black with crows all cawing at once. Then Jody's eyes followed the wagon road down from the ridge where he stood and lost it behind a hill and picked it up again on the other side. On that distant stretch he saw a cart slowly pulled by a bay horse. It disappeared behind the hill. Jody sat down on the ground and watched the place where the cart would reappear again. The wind sang on the hilltops and the puffball clouds hurried eastward. Then the cart came into sight and stopped. A man dressed in black dismounted from the seat and walked to the horse's head. Although it was so far away, Jody knew he had unhooked the check rein, for the horse's head dropped forward. The horse moved on, and the man walked slowly up the hill beside it. Jody gave a glad cry and ran down the road toward them. The squirrels bumped off along the road, and a roadrunner flirted its tail and raced over the edge of the hill and sailed out like a glider. Jody tried to leap into the middle of his shadow at every step. A stone rolled under his foot, and he went down. Around a little bend he raced, and there, a short distance ahead, were his grandfather and the cart. The boy dropped from his unseemly running and approached at a dignified walk. The horse plodded stumble-footedly up the hill, and the old man walked beside it. In the lowering sun, their giant shadows flickered darkly behind them. The grandfather was dressed in a black broadcloth suit, and he wore Kid Congress gaiters and a black tie on a short, hard collar. He carried his black slouch hat in his hand. His white beard was cropped close, and his white eyebrows overhung his eyes like mustaches. The blue eyes were sternly merry. About the whole face and figure there was a granite dignity, so that every motion seemed an impossible thing. Once at rest, it seemed the old man would be stone, would never move again. His steps were slow and certain. Once made, no step could ever be retraced. Once headed in a direction, the path would never bend, nor the pace increase nor slow. When Jody appeared around the bend, Grandfather waved his hat slowly in welcome, and he called, "Why, Jody, come down to meet me, have you?" Jody sidled near and turned and matched his step to the old man's step and stiffened his body and dragged his heels a little.
"Yes, sir," he said. "We got your letter only today."
"Should have been here yesterday," said Grandfather. "It certainly should. How are all the folks?"
"They're fine, sir."
He hesitated and then suggested shyly,
"Would you like to come on a mouse hunt tomorrow, sir?"
"Mouse hunt, Jody?" Grandfather chuckled. "Have the people of this generation come down to hunting mice? They aren't very strong, the new people, but I hardly thought mice would be game for them."
"No, sir, it's just play. The haystack's gone. I'm going to drive out the mice to the dogs, and you can watch, or even beat the hay a little."
The stern, merry eyes turned down on him.
"I see. You don't eat them, then. You haven't come to that yet."
Jody explained,
"The dogs eat them, sir. It wouldn't be much like hunting Indians, I guess."
"No, not much. But then later, when the troops were hunting Indians and shooting children and burning teepees, it wasn't much different from your mouse hunt."
They topped the rise and started down into the ranch cup, and they lost the sun from their shoulders.
"You've grown," Grandfather said. "Nearly an inch, I should say."
"More," Jody boasted. "Where they mark me on the door, I'm up more than an inch since Thanksgiving, even."
Grandfather's rich, throaty voice said,
"Maybe you're getting too much water and turning to pith and stock. Wait until you head out, and then we'll see."
Jody looked quickly into the man's face to see whether his feelings should be hurt, but there was no will to injure, no punishing nor putting in your place light in the keen blue eyes.
"We might kill a pig," Jody suggested.
"Oh, no. I couldn't let you do that. You're just humoring me. It isn't the time, and you know it."
"You know Riley, the big boar, sir?"
"Yes, I remember Riley well."
"Well, Riley ate a hole into that same haystack, and it fell down on him and smothered him."
"Pigs do that when they can," said Grandfather.
"Riley was a nice pig for a boar, sir. I rode him sometimes, and he didn't mind."
A door slammed at the house below them, and they saw Jody's mother standing on the porch, waving her apron in welcome. And they saw Carl Tiflin walking up from the barn to be at the house for the arrival. The sun had disappeared from the hills by now. The blue smoke from the house chimney hung in flat layers in the purpling ranch cup. The puffball clouds dropped by the falling wind hung listlessly in the sky. Billy Buck came out of the bunkhouse and flung a wash basin of soapy water on the ground. He had been shaving in midweek, for Billy held Grandfather in reverence, and Grandfather said that Billy was one of the few men of the new generation who had not gone soft. Although Billy was in middle age, Grandfather considered him a boy. Now Billy was hurrying toward the house, too. When Jody and Grandfather arrived, the three were waiting for them in front of the yard gate. Carl said, "Hello, sir. We've been looking for you." Mrs. Tiflin kissed Grandfather on the side of his beard and stood still while his big hand patted her shoulder. Billy shook hands solemnly, grinning under his straw mustache.
"I'll put up your horse," said Billy, and he led the rig away.
Grandfather watched him go, and then, turning back to the group, he said, as he had said 100 times before, "There's a good boy."
I knew his father, old Mule Tail Buck. I never knew why they called him Mule Tail, except he packed mules.
Mrs. Tiflin turned and led the way into the house. How long are you going to stay, Father? Your letter didn't say.
Well, I don't know. I thought I'd stay about 2 weeks, but I never stay as long as I think I'm going to.
In a short while they were sitting at the white oilcloth table eating their supper. The lamp with the tin reflector hung over the table. Outside the dining room windows, the big moths battered softly against the glass. Grandfather cut his steak into tiny pieces and chewed slowly.
"I'm hungry," he said. "Driving out here got my appetite up. It's like when we were crossing. We all got so hungry every night we could hardly wait to let the meat get done. I could eat about 5 pounds of buffalo meat every night."
"It's moving around, does it?" said Billy. "My father was a government packer. I helped him when I was a kid. Just the two of us could about clean up a deer's ham."
"I knew your father, Billy," said Grandfather. "A fine man he was. They called him Mule Tail Buck. I don't know why, except he packed mules."
"That was it," Billy agreed. "He packed mules."
Grandfather put down his knife and fork and looked around the table.
"I remember one time we ran out of meat."
His voice dropped to a curious low sing-song, dropped into a tonal groove the story had worn for itself.
"There was no buffalo, no antelope, not even rabbits. The hunters couldn't even shoot a coyote. That was the time for the leader to be on the watch. I was the leader, and I kept my eyes open. Know why? Well, just the minute the people began to get hungry, they'd start slaughtering the team oxen. Do you believe that? I've heard of parties that just ate up their draft cattle, started from the middle and worked toward the ends. Finally they'd eat the lead pair and then the wheelers. The leader of a party had to keep them from doing that."
In some manner a big moth got into the room and circled the hanging kerosene lamp. Billy got up and tried to clap it between his hands. Carl struck with a cupped palm and caught the moth and broke it. He walked to the window and dropped it out.
"As I was saying," Grandfather began again, but Carl interrupted him.
"You'd better eat some more meat. All the rest of us are ready for our pudding."
Jody saw a flash of anger in his mother's eyes. Grandfather picked up his knife and fork.
"I'm pretty hungry, all right," he said. "I'll tell you about that later."
When supper was over, when the family and Billy Buck sat in front of the fireplace in the other room, Jody anxiously watched Grandfather. He saw the signs he knew. The bearded head leaned forward. The eyes lost their sternness and looked wonderingly into the fire. The big lean fingers laced themselves on the black knees.
"I wonder," he began. "I just wonder whether I ever told you how those thieving Paiutes drove off 35 of our horses."
"I think you did," Carl interrupted. "Wasn't it just before you went up into the Tahoe country?"
Grandfather turned quickly toward his son-in-law.
"That's right. I guess I must have told you that story."
"Lots of times," Carl said cruelly, and he avoided his wife's eyes. But he felt the angry eyes on him, and he said, "Of course, I'd like to hear it again." Grandfather looked back at the fire. His fingers unlaced and laced again. Jody knew how he felt, how his insides were collapsed and empty. Hadn't Jody been called a big britches that very afternoon? He arose to heroism and opened himself to the term big britches again.
"Tell about Indians," he said softly.
Grandfather's eyes grew stern again.
"Boys always want to hear about Indians. It was a job for men, but boys want to hear about it. Well, let's see. Did I ever tell you how I wanted each wagon to carry a long iron plate?"
Everyone but Jody remained silent. Jody said,
"No, you didn't."
"Well, when the Indians attacked, we always put the wagons in a circle and fought from between the wheels.
I thought that if every wagon carried a long plate with rifle holes, the men could stand the plates on the outside of the wheels when the wagons were in the circle and they would be protected. It would save lives, and that would make up for the extra weight of the iron. But, of course, a party wouldn't do it. No party had done it before, and they couldn't see why they should go to the expense. They lived to regret it, too.
Jody looked at his mother and knew from her expression that she was not listening at all. Carl picked at a callus on his thumb, and Billy Buck watched a spider crawling up the wall. Grandfather's tone dropped into its narrative groove again. Jody knew in advance exactly what words would fall. The story droned on, speeded up for the attack, grew sad over the wounds, struck a dirge at the burials on the Great Plains. Jody sat quietly watching Grandfather. The stern blue eyes were detached. He looked as though he were not very interested in the story himself. When it was finished, when the pause had been politely respected as the frontier of the story, Billy Buck stood up and stretched and hitched his trousers.
"I guess I'll turn in," he said. Then he faced Grandfather. "I've got an old powder horn and a cap-and-ball pistol down to the bunkhouse. Did I ever show them to you?"
Grandfather nodded slowly.
"Yes, I think you did, Billy. Reminds me of a pistol I had when I was leading the people across."
Billy stood politely until the little story was done, and then he said,
"Good night,"
and went out of the house. Carl Tiflin tried to turn the conversation then.
"How's the country between here and Monterey? I've heard it's pretty dry."
"It is dry," said Grandfather. "There's not a drop of water in the Laguna Seca. But it's a long pull from 87. The whole country was powder then, and in 61, I believe, all the coyotes starved to death. We had 15 inches of rain this year."
"Yes, but it all came too early. We could do with some now."
Carl's eye fell on Jody.
"Hadn't you better be getting to bed?"
Jody stood up obediently.
"Can I kill the mice in the old haystack, sir?"
"Mice? Oh. Sure, kill 'em all off. Billy said there isn't any good hay left."
Jody exchanged a secret and satisfying look with Grandfather.
"I'll kill everyone tomorrow," he promised.
Jody lay in his bed and thought of the impossible world of Indians and buffaloes, a world that had ceased to be forever. He wished he could have been living in the heroic time, but he knew he was not of heroic timber. No one living now, save possibly Billy Buck, was worthy to do the things that had been done. A race of giants had lived then, fearless men, men of a staunchness unknown in this day. Jody thought of the wide plains and of the wagons moving across like centipedes. He thought of Grandfather on a huge white horse, marshaling the people. Across his mind marched the great phantoms, and they marched off the earth, and they were gone. He came back to the ranch for a moment then. He heard the dull rushing sound that space and silence make. He heard one of the dogs out in the doghouse scratching a flea and bumping his elbow against the floor with every stroke. Then the wind arose again, and the black cypress groaned, and Jody went to sleep. He was up half an hour before the triangle sounded for breakfast. His mother was rattling the stove to make the flames roar when Jody went through the kitchen.
"You're up early," she said. "Where are you going?" "Out to get a good stick. We're going to kill the mice today."
"Who is we?"
"Why, Grandfather and I."
"So you've got him in it. You always like to have someone in with you in case there's blame to share."
"I'll be right back," said Jody. "I just want to have a good stick ready for after breakfast."
He closed the screen door after him and went out into the cool blue morning. The birds were noisy in the dawn, and the ranch cats came down from the hill like blunt snakes. They had been hunting gophers in the dark, and although the four cats were full of gopher meat, they sat in a semicircle at the back door and mewed piteously for milk. Doubletree Mutt and Smasher moved sniffing along the edge of the brush, performing the duty with rigid ceremony, But when Jody whistled, their heads jerked up and their tails waved. They plunged down to him, wriggling their skins and yawning. Jody patted their heads seriously and moved on to the weathered scrap pile. He selected an old broom handle and a short piece of inch-square scrap wood. From his pocket, he took a shoelace and tied the ends of the sticks loosely together to make a flail. He whistled his new weapon through the air and struck the ground experimentally while the dogs leaped aside and whined with apprehension. Jody turned and started down past the house toward the old haystack ground to look over the field of slaughter, but Billy Buck, sitting patiently on the back steps, called to him.
"You better come back. It's only a couple of minutes till breakfast."
Jody changed his course and moved toward the house. He leaned his flail against the steps.
"That's to drive the mice out," he said. "I'll bet they're fat. I'll bet they don't know what's going to happen to them today."
"No, nor you either," Billy remarked philosophically. "Nor me, nor anyone."
Jody was staggered by this thought. He knew it was true. His imagination twitched away from the mouse hunt. Then his mother came out on the back porch and struck the triangle, and all thoughts fell in a heap. Grandfather hadn't appeared at the table when they sat down. Billy nodded at his empty chair. "He's all right. He isn't sick."
"He takes a long time to dress," said Mrs. Tiflin. "He combs his whiskers and rubs up his shoes and brushes his clothes."
Carl scattered sugar on his mush. "A man that's led a wagon train across the plains has got to be pretty careful how he dresses."
Mrs. Tiflin turned on him. "Don't do that, Carl. Please don't."
There was more of a threat than of request in her tone. And the threat irritated Carl.
"Well, how many times do I have to listen to the story of the iron plates and the 35 horses? That time's done. Why can't he forget it now it's done?"
He grew angrier while he talked, and his voice rose.
"Why does he have to tell them over and over? He came across the plains. All right. Now it's finished. Nobody wants to hear about it over and over."
The door into the kitchen closed softly. The four at the table sat frozen. Carl laid his mush spoon on the table and touched his chin with his fingers. Then the kitchen door opened and Grandfather walked in. His mouth smiled tightly and his eyes were squinted.
"Good morning," he said, and he sat down and looked at his mush dish.
Carl could not leave it there.
Did you hear what I said?"
Grandfather jerked a little nod.
"I don't know what got into me, sir. I didn't mean it. I was just being funny."
Jody glanced in shame at his mother, and he saw that she was looking at Carl and that she wasn't breathing. It was an awful thing that he was doing. He was tearing himself to pieces to talk like that. It was a terrible thing to him to retract a word, but to retract it in shame was infinitely worse. Grandfather looked sidewise.
"I'm trying to get right side up," he said gently. "I'm not being mad. I don't mind what you said, but it might be true, and I would mind that."
"It isn't true," said Carl. "I'm not feeling well this morning. I'm sorry I said it."
"Don't be sorry, Carl. An old man doesn't see things sometimes. Maybe you're right. The crossing is finished. Maybe it should be forgotten now it's done."
Carl got up from the table.
"I've had enough to eat. I'm going to work. Take your time, Billy."
He walked quickly out of the dining room. Billy gulped the rest of his food and followed soon after. But Jody could not leave his chair.
"Won't you tell any more stories?" Jody asked.
"Why, sure, I'll tell 'em. But only when I'm sure people want to hear 'em."
"I like to hear 'em, sir."
"Oh, of course you do, but you're a little boy. It was a job for men, but only little boys like to hear about it."
Jody got up from his place.
"I'll wait outside for you, sir. I've got a good stick for those mice."
He waited by the gate until the old man came out on the porch.
"Let's go down and kill the mice now," Jody called.
"I think I'll just sit in the sun, Jody. You go kill the mice."
"You can use my stick if you like."
"No. I'll just sit here a while."
Jody turned disconsolately away and walked down toward the old haystack. He tried to whip up his enthusiasm with thoughts of the fat, juicy mice. He beat the ground with his flail. The dogs coaxed and whined about him, but he could not go. Back at the house, he could see Grandfather sitting on the porch, looking small and thin and black. Jody gave up and went to sit on the steps at the old man's feet.
"Back already? Did you kill the mice?"
"No, sir. I'll kill them some other day."
The morning flies buzzed close to the ground, and the ants dashed about in front of the steps. The heavy smell of sage slipped down the hill. The porch boards grew warm in the sunshine. Jody hardly knew when Grandfather started to talk.
"I shouldn't stay here, feeling the way I do."
He examined his strong, old hands.
"I feel as though the crossing wasn't worth doing."
His eyes moved up the side hill and stopped on a motionless hawk perched on a dead limb.
"I tell those old stories, but they're not what I want to tell. I only know how I want people to feel when I tell them. It wasn't Indians that were important, nor adventures, nor even getting out here. It was a whole bunch of people made into one big crawling beast, and I was the head. It was westering and westering. Every man wanted something for himself, but the big beast that was all of them wanted, only westering. I was the leader. But if I hadn't been there, someone else would have been the head. The thing had to have a head. Under the little bushes, the shadows were black at white noonday. When we saw the mountains at last, we cried. All of us. But it wasn't getting here that mattered. It was movement and westering. We carried life out here, and set it down the way those ants carry eggs. And I was the leader. The westering was as big as God, and the slow steps that made the movement piled up and piled up until the continent was crossed. Then we came down to the sea, and it was done." He stopped and wiped his eyes until the rims were red. "That's what I should be telling instead of stories." When Jody spoke, Grandfather started and looked down at him.
"Maybe I could lead the people someday," Jody said.
The old man smiled.
"There's no place to go. There's the ocean to stop you. There's a line of old men along the shore hating the ocean because it stopped them."
"In boats I might, sir."
"No place to go, Jody. Every place is taken. But that's not the worst. No, not the worst. Westering has died out of the people. Westering isn't a hunger anymore. It's all done. Your father is right. It is finished."
He laced his fingers on his knee and looked at them. Jody felt very sad.
"If you'd like a glass of lemonade, I could make it for you."
Grandfather was about to refuse, and then he saw Jody's face.
"That would be nice," he said.
"Yes.
It would be nice to drink a lemonade."
Jody ran into the kitchen where his mother was wiping the last of the breakfast dishes.
"Can I have a lemon to make a lemonade for Grandfather?"
His mother mimicked, "And another lemon to make a lemonade for you."
"No, ma'am, I don't want one."
"Jody, you're sick."
Then she stopped suddenly.
"Take a lemon out of the cooler," she said softly. "Here, I'll reach the squeezer down to you."
The End.
We hope that you've enjoyed this production of The Red Pony by John Steinbeck. This production was produced by Recorded Books, LLC. The Red Pony is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA, Inc., and Recorded Books, LLC. Copyright 2011. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.